Good morning from Northern California. It's time for another reading of The Lady in Gold, the extraordinary tale of Gustav Klimt's masterpiece, Portrait of Adele Blochbauer, by Anne-Marie O'Connor. This title today, this piece of the book, is called Maria and Luis. If Ferdinand and Adele had raised girls, they might have encouraged them to take up a career. Adele's best friends were career women in an age when women did not take up professions. Bertha Zuckerkandel was now a prominent journalist and cultural critic. Dr. Gertrude Bien was a respected physician. Teresa, however, brought her girls in a sheltered manner designed to lead to marriage within their cultured circle. Their aunt Adele had spent her life trying to be remarkable. Maria and Luis were encouraged to be ordinary, unusual only within their carefully circumscribed conventions. Maria was a child of 8 when her glamorous older sister turned 16. Luis was an unusually poised teenager with a willowy figure and a biting wit. An insomniac, Luis stayed up into the wee hours and woke Maria to tell her thrilling details of the love affairs of actors and aristocrats. Maria was in awe of stylish Louise, whose first evening gowns were made by the fashion house of Klimt's old companion, Emily Floge. Louise was mature enough to disarm guests with her bon mot at the salons of her Aunt Adele and Uncle Ferdinand. Maria was too shy to do much more than stand by the curtains watching Adele hold forth in a long gown, her cigarette holder draped from her long, elegant fingers. At Ferdinand's Brezany Castle, outside of Prague, Maria was the youngest guest. She would wander through the drafty rooms filled with Baroque antiques of dark woods, heavily carved with swans and lions, and the formal and uncomfortable furniture of the Biedermeier period. Meals were served at precise hours, and servants helped everyone dress for dinner. Luis and her brothers went off to hunt with Ferdinand. Maria loved Bambi, and she cried when she read the passage where the fawn's mother was shot by hunters. When she saw the group return jubilantly one day with a dead stag, targeted for his magnificent rack of antlers, Maria burst into tears. Ferdinand's gardens were a well-tended park with statues and topiaries. The girls begged Ferdinand to dig a pool at Brezany, but it was futile. It didn't appeal to his classical tastes. It didn't appeal to his classical tastes, and Ferdinand had no interest in donning a swimming costume. Though the girls were discouraged from any real vocation, they were expected to be conversant in the world of culture. Luis read widely, devouring Goethe and Schiller. She had a genius for languages and dreamed of writing plays. She was studying to be a teacher, but Teresa viewed finding a good husband to be Luis's primary vocation. This posed little challenge. By 18, Luis was a scene stealer. She spun around the dance floor at Vienna balls, dressed with style and ease, and was a skillful flirt. By day, she flitted around the house singing her favorite opera, Du Fledermaus. Happy he who forges, no, sorry, happy he who forgets what cannot be changed. By night, Louise accompanied lonely Uncle Fairy to the theater or opera, and the socially prominent widower loved to make an entrance with his stunning niece on his arm. Therese was the anchor of Blockbauer gatherings, invitations to which were coveted in Vienna. Unlike Adele's, these gatherings were designed less for the exchange of ideas than for the family's social advancement. Guests ate at a long, deeply carved formal dining table. A Dutch tapestry covered one wall, and guests dined under the gaze of the tapestry harlequin, who watched with vicarious pleasure as a busy maiden tried to squirm out of the embrace of a rogue nobleman. Some of Adele's old friends still came to dine, like Alma Mahler and Amelie Zuckerkandel, whose father, Sigmund Schlesinger, had written an unfinished play with Mark Twain. At one Blockbauer lunch, Louise caught the eye of a handsome blonde aristocrat and moved her seating card next to his. Teresa had other plans. She seated the blonde next to Louise's best friend, Renee Rain, and a socially connected young woman who was a confidant of the aging Katharina Schratt. Teresa put Louise's card back in his place next to that of one of Vienna's most eligible bachelors, Baron Victor Gutmann, heir to a vast timber operation in Yugoslavia. The Gutmann barons were philanthropic. One had paid for the studies of the Hungarian carpenter's son who fathered Vienna playwright Arthur Schnitzler. Victor Gutmann was a dashing young man who had returned from the Eastern Front of World War I in a braid-trimmed officer's uniform festooned with medals. It was Victor whom Teresa had in mind when she began to plan the brilliant illusion that would be Louise's debutante ball, an affair she plotted like a general deploying an army. Teresa decided on a flower cotillion. On the morning of the ball, Maria opened the door at the Stubenbastei, and florists marched in with armloads of orchids, lilies, hyacinths, and tiny white lilies of the valley. They wove the flowers into wicker archways, transforming them into bloom-laden arbors. Wreaths of blossoms hung over the doorways. Maria was still a gangly girl of 10, with a swaying walk that earned her the nickname Duckling. She was disappointed to learn her role. Teresa wanted Maria to pull a toy donkey cart filled with bouquets and whinny like a horse. When the guests arrived, servants passed them little flutes of champagne. Maria obediently neighed and trotted by the elegantly attired guests. The glamorous Baron Gutmann smiled indulgently, and Maria felt the first stirrings of self-consciousness and humiliation. She was not a little girl anymore, but she dutifully pulled the cart, handing out bouquets. Suddenly, Louise appeared in the doorway in a sleek gown. Even the chamber musicians stopped to stare at her. Then they struck up the first notes of a waltz. Baron Gutmann put down his champagne glass and took Louise by the hand to lead her through the first dance. Maria set down her cart and watched as Victor and Louise glided away, her slender arm on his shoulder, his hand barely touching the small of her back. Baron Gutmann casually put his lips to Louise's ear to tell her something that made her throw her head back with laughter as they whirled around the room. It was no surprise when Louise and Victor announced their engagement. In contrast to his 19-year-old fiancé, Victor was a well-traveled man of 34 who had known many women. Victor had a roving eye, something that Louise, accustomed to being the center of attention, found maddening. Her first taste of jealousy was a disconcerting surprise. Their engagement was stormy, passionate, and brief. A few months after her debutante ball, Louise stepped into the ornate, gilded Stadt Temple in an ivory silk wedding gown. She wore simple white pearls and an intricate handmade lace veil that fell rakishly over her eyes. Teresa ordered Maria, now 11, to carry the long train of Louise's gown. Maria was to pull carefully, so Louise would sally forth regally. Hold back, she strides like a queen. No, hold back so she strides like a queen, Teresa whispered to Maria, just before her duckling walked into the synagogue behind Louise. Maria tugged on Louise's dress as hard as she could, while Louise beamed radiantly at the upturned, admiring faces. Maria must have pulled too tightly, because as Louise strode down the aisle, smiling blandly, she hissed iratedly to her sister, "Trottle, idiot! Walk faster!" Maria's face burned with shame. Louise's wedding banquet featured a printed menu with course after course of French dishes, each with its own wine. There was potage à la crème d'orange with Chateau 1916 Coutet. Truites au bleu sauce mayonnaise with Nierensteiner Gransberg 1917. Sel de chevril, Vautier et le Cumberland, and Fonds d'Artichauts, au Ponts d'Asperge. With Palmery sec dessert was Crème à la Fraise de la Saison, sorry about the pronunciation, with Chateau Grand Lacan Cajon, 1914, and French cheese, Viennese pastry, and fresh fruit. For her wedding photo, Louise stared up seductively like the floating faces of Klimt's sirens. As Maria grew toward adolescence, she was the mirthful, loyal sister. Louise was the poised beauty of society pages. Even as a married woman, Louise mingled with cosmopolitan crowd, peopled by actors, singers, and aristocrats. Louise told Maria titillating stories, like the time a married friend left her husband in the opera box for a breathtaking sexual tryst with her lover in a dark velvet curtain niche of the Vienna State Opera, while Louise made excuses until her friend returned. To sheltered Maria, it was a thrill when, at 16, a boy she had tremendous crush on pulled her into his arms for her first real kiss on a boat on Lake Attersea. He pressed his body against hers, and Maria was so surprised she almost tipped the boat over. She told her best friend, Crystal, believing the kiss to prelude to a courtship. But when Maria saw the boy at a party, he greeted her casually and moved on to speak to another teenage girl. Maria was crushed. Not all her contemporaries were so naive. Crystal was already having a very adult affair with Anton Felsavagne, a scion of the prominent titled family that owned the distinguished Low Sanitarium, where Gustav Mahler had died. Felsavagne, like other young men of the upper class, attended Vienna's Theresianum, a castle-like military school that took up an entire block near the Belvedere Palace. The Theresianum's love affair with the past was nearly necrophiliac. In the library, two crumbling mummies, the gift of an Egyptian prince whose sons had studied there, lay in a glass case, along with a crocodile that appeared to be rotting. Crystal and Anton took Maria to a basement wine bar near Vienna's old city hall, where Anton invited his rakish school friends to flirt with Maria. Anton's grandfather, Dr. Anton Lowe, had been a friend of Adele. But his less approving mother, Gertrude Felsovani, characterized Adele as a flaming socialist. At Anton's elegant family mansion on Pelikangasse, he showed Maria the Klimt portrait of his mother in a white gown, an ethereally untouched maiden. So unlike the sultry gold portrait of Adele that Ferdinand kept in his shrine, to Maria, Anton was a bit of a Philistine. His mother bought him orchestra seats for Richard Wagner's masterpiece, Du Wacker, and he described it as torture. Hours and hours of those women shrieking. Maria and Crystal had played together since they were children in the little plaza off the Ringstrasse that honored Karl Luger, the former Viennese mayor who famously pronounced that, quote, "I decide who is a Jew," end quote. Settling this question was more difficult than ever after generations of intermarriage in Vienna. Crystal's father, a good-looking, dull blonde bureaucrat, was Catholic. Her mother, a baptized Jew. Families like Crystal's had become common. Crystal grew into a spirited young woman whose self-confidence was the envy of Maria. Anton Felsovani conquered Crystal with all the weapons in his privileged arsenal. He took her to dine at absurdly extravagant restaurants. He arranged private carriage rides in the Vienna woods. Soon, Crystal was telling Maria how Anton kissed and caressed her until she was incapable of resisting him. He gave her an expensive gold necklace and a puppy to walk. He told her he wanted to marry her. Anton did not want to marry Crystal. He went to her house regularly to chat with her father, who told Anton of his admiration of Adolf Hitler. Crystal rolled her eyes and complained that her father was a big Nazi, a member of Vienna's secret illegal fraternity. Hans, the fiancé of Crystal's sister, was also a Nazi party member. Over beers, Hans told Anton his dream of the unification of all German peoples, of the national socialism that would provide jobs and restore Austria to greatness. Anton had been an activist in a competing Austrian fascist group, the Einwehr, or Home Defense. Anton loved its parties, hosted by the Einwehr leader Prince Starhemberg, and he had vied to dance with leggy young Hedy Kaisler, who would soon be known as Hedy Lamarr. Crystal was hardly Anton's first affair. Wealthy young men like Anton did as they pleased. Felsovani's mother was said to be the child of her own mother's affair with a Hungarian general. Anton's mother usually ignored her son's indiscretions, but with Crystal she intervened. She didn't raise her son to marry the daughter of a petty civil servant. Gertrude paid a discreet visit to Crystal's father. She quietly explained that Crystal's relationship with Anton was growing far too serious for his daughter's own good. The conservative patriarch immediately understood. Crystal wept. Anton consoled himself by quickly overwhelming the innocence of an adoring aristocratic girl whose pedigree impressed his mother. Maria was offended. How could Gertrude Felsovani reject Crystal when her son wasted his time at nightclubs and parties? And that is the end of that chapter. The next reading is called Stubenbastei. And it seems short. Maybe I should just add it here. No, I guess I'll do it separately. Yeah, I'll go ahead now. Stubenbastei. The Blockbauer residence on the Stubenbastei embodied the glamour of old Vienna for Gustav Rinisch, a tall, handsome rake who, at as one of Vienna's most eligible bachelors, was certain he could win the heart of Maria Blachbar. His spirits never failed to rise when he turned down the lovely walking street that marked the one-time Steuben bastion of walled Vienna. Reinsch found Maria's world on Steuben Bastei, with its inside jokes, cultured visitors, and in the endless family intrigues, a seductive place indeed. Reinsch was one of the growing number of Catholic attorneys in Vienna who worked for a Jewish law firm. Jewish firms offered some of the best opportunities. Jews, just 2.8% of the population of Austria, made up more than half of Austria's lawyers, doctors, dentists, and their firms and factories now employed many non-Jewish Austrians in top positions. Reinsch relished the entree his job gave him into Vienna high society. The Jewish intelligentsia was for Reinsch the spirit of the town. He considered the Jewish elite very humanistic and admired Jewish humor, the way they can laugh at themselves very easily. In fact, the laughter and conversation at Steuben Bastei was robbing his bachelor freedom of its appeal. Reinsch was a regular at the Friday night gatherings at Steuben Bastei, where Gustav Blachbauer played cello with his quartet. Here, Reinsch rubbed shoulders with dapper composer Erich Wolfgang Korngold, with the librettist Franz Lehár, with Alma Mahler. Maria was pining for Fritz Altmann, an aspiring opera singer with a mediocre baritone. But Reinsch knew her infatuation with this glib ladies' man would run its course. For now, he bided his time carousing around Vienna with Maria's brother Robert, a real womanizer who spent his time cultivating good-looking women, mostly from non-Jewish society, who always fell immediately into the bed of his rented pied-à-terre. Therese approved of Reinsch, who had a saucy grin but a proper air of respect. Therese hoped Maria would take Reinsch more seriously when they returned from their summer at Ischgl. But as the family prepared to leave Vienna that summer of 1937, Gustav received an unexpected caller. Bernard Altmann swept into the house, sporting a well-cut suit and a hearty, affectionate air. Bernard greeted Maria with fatherly warmth as she smiled up at him with the amusement that melted his tough reserve. Bernard liked strong women, from his mother and sister to his wife and mistress, but he was disarmed by Maria's sweetness. Gustav made no secret of his admiration for Bernard. He invited him to sit down in one of the leather chairs of his book-lined study and closed the doors. The only thing to emerge was the scent of fine cigars, the murmur of men's voices, and deep laughter. Maria soon learned the reason for the visit. Bernard wanted to know if the Blachbauers would accept an Altmann into the family. Bernard was impatient with Fritz's affair with the married woman. He was a close friend of the woman's husband and felt it was time to put a stop to it. Gustav didn't know Fritz well, though he knew Fritz shared his love for music, but Maria's indulgent father was inclined to give his blessing to a match with Fritz, if that was his daughter's wish. The Altmanns were nouveau, and only Bernard was riche. But that had come a long way from hand-scrabble Galicia. But they had come a long way from hard-scrabble Galicia and the cramped Leopoldstadt apartment of their Yiddish-speaking parents. When Fritz found out about Bernard's visit, he was furious. Yes, he found Maria very charming. You'd have to be blind not to see she was beautiful. But Fritz was deeply smitten with his mistress. Fritz appealed directly to Maria. He sent Maria a fine porcelain bowl, hand-painted with tiny flowers that cradled a blooming orchid. Maria eagerly opened the ivory envelope, anticipating her long-awaited romantic letter from Fritz. Finally, if I were a prince and you were a princess, and a fairy godmother could put you to sleep for a year, it would work, Fritz wrote. But this is real life. so I must say goodbye. It will be a year before you hear from me." Maria was crushed. Soon Maria and her parents were on the train to Bad Ischl in Austria's Salzkammergut, the old Celtic salt mining region that was once the exclusive retreat of emperors. A place where snow-capped mountains cupped deep blue lakes and freezing streams rushed madly into valleys and villages where salt miners still turned up Celtic spears and knives. Summer stretched before Maria, with rides down country roads in horse-drawn fiakers, I have not seen that word, and walks in high mountain meadows filled with Edelweiss. But Maria couldn't have been more miserable. And that we will end there. It's a little bit longer reading today. The next chapter is called The House Painter from Austria. We are now on page 99. I hope you're enjoying the story. It's taking a while to get through this, but I am still enjoying reading it. Ciao.